So I have one gripe about chip bags, especially for the single serve. It seems to me very suboptimal to have the only opening at the top, where you kind of have to jam your hand in there and you can't really see what you're getting. Wouldn't it be better to have a bag that just laid out all the chips on the package, like a nice picnic blanket or something? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, imagine that you're walking around eating a bag of chips, which a lot of people do. How would that work? If you open out the Lay's too much and a gust of wind comes by, you're going to see a lot of chips flying. We have to worry about all these little practical things.
That's Indra Nooyi.
Good morning.
She is the CEO of PepsiCo. So when it comes to little practical things to worry about, she has a lot of them. PepsiCo has more than 260,000 global employees and over 100 brands and trademarks, including 22 that each do at least $1 billion a year in sales. Those include Pepsi, of course, and Gatorade and Tropicana and Quaker Foods. There are also 7 separate billion-dollar chip brands: Lay's, Ruffles, Doritos, Tostitos, Cheetos, Fritos, and Walkers.
So I'm out in the marketplace almost every week looking to see how our products look like on the shelf, not from a CEO lens, more from a consumer lens. Because at the end of the day, I'm not just a CEO, I'm also a consumer. I'm a shopkeeper, I'm a gatekeeper of my family. So I look at our business through a different lens. And then I come back and I talk to my people about what I saw was good and what wasn't really good.
Do you find it surprising that the CEO of a $155 billion company micromanages her potato chips? What about the CEO of an even bigger company, one built on silicon chips? I'm talking about Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella.
These hard decisions around what to pick and focus on is something that I believe a CEO uniquely has to do. That's not something that you can delegate.
And what if you're the CEO of a social networking company with 2 billion global users? How micro do you think Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg gets?
So when I was in Ohio, I sat down with a group of heroin addicts. And, you know, one of the things that was really interesting is, when you're going through recovery, the first thing you have to do is detox, of course. But then after that, the next thing you have to do is basically get new friends, right? And it turns out if you remain friends with anyone who you were using with before, then you are very likely to end up back using heroin and endangering your life.
Okay, be honest with me. What's the first thing that comes to mind when I say CEO? For many people, the image is a caricature, either supervillain or superhero. At the very least, you probably envision a luxe life with 100 rounds of golf a year.
I think that CEOs work harder today than ever before.
That's Jeff Sonnenfeld from the Yale School of Management. He spent more than 30 years scrutinizing CEOs.
These aren't people that are hanging out and golfing and running around country clubs and sipping on their sherries late afternoon. These are people that are working nonstop, 40-hour days, 8 days a week.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, we are launching The Secret Life of CEOs, a special series that'll get inside the minds of these rare and rarefied creatures. Some of the questions we'll be asking: what do CEOs actually do? What makes a good CEO, and how can you even tell? Why do CEOs make so much money, and are they worth it? How did they get to be where they are, and is it lonely at the top? You'll hear from lots of big-time CEOs, as well as the academics who know them best.
Indra is an unbelievably brilliant person. There's a peripatetic quality, of course, to Mark Zuckerberg.
Ray Dalio is a paradox. Charles Bartz is incredible.
Nadella had kind of the toughest combination of all.
With Branson, somehow the whole focus is on him.
The protégés of Jack Welch, some of them loved him, some of them didn't.
And if you find yourself thinking, hey, I'd like to do that too,
it's frankly a horrible job. I wouldn't want it.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Let's begin with this guy.
I'm Nicholas Bloom. I'm a professor of economics at Stanford University.
And if I were to just ask you, what's your general specialty?
I work on trying to understand management practices. So why some firms are better managed than others and how that helps improve their performance.
All right. We are doing a multi-part series on CEOs. So let me ask you an incredibly rudimentary question. What does a CEO actually do? Because, you know, I think everybody knows what a CEO is, but I would argue that most of us really have almost no idea what a CEO actually does, both on a day-to-day and on a year-to-year basis.
Their mandate is they're part public figure. So if anything goes wrong or right with the company, they're the man or woman standing up in the press, taking the flack or the praise. They spend about a day a week talking to Wall Street and, you know, other big investors. They also spend a huge amount of time on personal management, human resources. So generally, they'll have something like 5 to 10 direct reports, people they'll see once a week that work, you know, the chief of finance, the chief of HR, the chief of information. It's much more, the coach. If you think of a football team, it's very much like that with CEOs. They, you know, in some ways, they're the masterminds behind the scene, but they don't actually, you know, throw the ball or actually have their hands directly involved in the business.
I deal with people who are going to be CEOs one day.
That is Rafaela Sadoun. She's an economist who teaches at Harvard Business School.
I'm very interested in understanding how management and managers affect firm performance.
So how much time does a CEO spend on their own, thinking blue sky thoughts?
There is very little time that goes into thinking alone or being in their solitary office and looking outside the window. We tend to think about the CEO sitting in an ivory tower, deciding what the organization will do, and then boom, they make a decision and the decision just happens and everybody's happy. But there is so much variation in how well firms adopt even the very basics of management, and you can't ignore it. That's not below the pay grade of the CEO. It's very important that the CEO keeps in mind both the strategic and the operational aspects of their jobs.
And yet, Sadoun says, that view is not shared by her MBA students, her future CEOs. They see strategy as paramount. How a firm responds to rivals or a shift in the market or consumer preferences. Operations, meanwhile, how goods or services actually get made and delivered, how the quality is controlled, how you monitor and track employee performance, that is not what they're thinking about.
When we were teaching cases that had a lot of these operational aspects in it, my students were telling me that that's the easy stuff, right? that was not, you know, that's not strategy. That's easy. Everybody can do it, or you can pay somebody to do it. And, you know, when you look at what happens inside firms, you just know that that's not true.
Rafaela Sadoun, along with Nicholas Bloom and the MIT economist John Van Reenen, analyzed data for more than 12,000 companies to try to learn what makes some better than others. Management practices, they wrote, can account for a large fraction of performance differences. And yet, they argued, quote, achieving operational excellence is still a massive challenge for many organizations.
You know, the hygiene of management. So things like, do you collect data? Do you use it to analyze what's going on? Do you have thorough performance reviews? And in fact, many of the most successful companies in the world, companies like GE, McDonald's and Walmart, are excessively focused on managerial competence. You know, they're unbelievably detail orientated. And that's one of their big ingredients of their success. So my sense of teaching students is often they get overexcited about the big picture, sexy stuff of, long-term strategy and kind of skip over the small details, which turn out to be critically important.
So how difficult is basic managerial competence and what keeps people from achieving it?
You'd think that basic managerial competence is actually easy to do. I mean, in some senses, it's been around for over 100 years. So Frederick Winslow Taylor came out with something called scientific management in 1913, which was, you know, about using stopwatches and monitoring and data. And, you know, roll us forward 100 years and it's been called in many ways big data. On the other hand, we just see tremendous variations. And I think it's because it's important, but it's boring and tedious and takes effort. And it's hard for people to get it right.
Okay, so basic managerial competence may be unsexy. Still, if it's so important, why don't CEOs pay it more attention? Here's one explanation.
A good CEO has to play five or six different constituencies.
That, again, is Jeff Sonnenfeld of the Yale School of Management. He's also president of the Chief Executive Leadership Institute at Yale.
There is the shareholder as the actual financial owners of the business. And we have others with a stake in the business, bondholders, debt holders. There are, of course, concerns as an employer that they're seen as an employer of choice. And, of course, that employees have an opportunity that they're investing in training. And is there metrics that are created to take a look at their community impact, both environmentally and as a good corporate citizen to their immediate communities? But a fifth constituency is consumers. Are they getting healthy, a safe product? Is there a sense of accountability? Is there a warranty that the products work as they should and that companies are responsive?
Okay, those are a lot of constituencies to balance. Being CEO is starting to sound like a fairly impossible job, and I'd assume a fairly important one as well. I'd assume that who the CEO is at a given moment matters a great deal to whether that company will thrive. But let's not assume. Let me ask you this question, not about yourself as CEO, but about CEOs of other firms. How much does the CEO really matter to the firm, and how can you tell?
I believe a CEO matters a lot more than I probably thought before.
That's David Rubenstein, co-founder and, until recently, co-CEO of the Carlyle Group, one of the biggest private equity firms in the world.
Private equity is a phrase that is used to explain the investing of money typically in a company that is privately owned, i.e. it's not public, and you spend 3 to 5 years improving the company, incenting the managers to work harder, do more efficient things, and ultimately, after 3 or 5 years, you sell or otherwise liquefy the investment.
Since its founding in 1987, Carlyle has purchased or invested in nearly 600 companies and sold off more than 300. Today, it has more than 250 companies under its control. So, besides serving as a CEO of Carlyle, Rubenstein was also involved in making sure that Carlyle-acquired companies have the right CEO, and if not, bring in a new one.
In all the companies Carlyle's invested in, I think the CEO has made the most amount of difference. I think the price we paid is probably the second most, and the quality of the company we invested in was probably the third most. So if you told me you had a reasonably good company, a terrible CEO, I wouldn't invest in it. If you told me you had a reasonably good company and a great CEO, I certainly would invest in it.
Rubenstein plainly has massive experience in shopping for and observing CEOs, so who are we to challenge his opinion that the CEO is the single most important component of a firm's success? But here's the thing. It is largely his opinion. It isn't empirical evidence. That's what researchers like Nicholas Bloom try to come up with.
So I've been working for 20 years trying to understand what makes some firms perform better than others.
To that end, Bloom has some good news and some bad news. The good news is that researchers have found, as David Rubenstein argues, that the leader of a company matters a great deal. The bad news?
No one could really give us a straight answer on what defined a good or a bad leader.
In other words, no one can really say what indicates or predicts or produces a good leader.
And I must have pitched this question, you know, dozens and dozens of times. You know, you look at the data and there's 10 different recipes for success. Maybe they each work for a particular case studies, but I've still 20 years later struggled to find anything that's the secret recipe beyond saying, sure, there are some people that are better than others, but it's damn hard to tell what it is.
So one big problem with your kind of research is that you can't randomly assign CEOs to control groups and treatment groups. But if you could, if you somehow had the, you know, permission and resources to set up the perfect randomized experiment to learn whatever you want to learn about CEOs, or maybe it's several things, how to build the perfect CEO or how to preemptively tell a great one from a terrible one, what would those experiments look like?
Oh, this is the researcher's dream, is to go out there and randomly move CEOs around companies. And, you know, it doesn't happen in America. It probably happens in North Korea, but they're not sharing their data with us. And, but yeah, ideally, you take a bunch of firms and a bunch of CEOs, and, you know, every 5 years, you flip coins and you rotate them around. And pretty soon, you'd find what makes a good leader and what doesn't. The problem is right now, that just never happens.
We have a lot of anecdotal evidence about CEOs, about what they actually do.
That, again, is Rafaela Sadoun.
But very little large-scale representative evidence.
So coming up on Freakonomics Radio, let's get some large-scale representative evidence.
So she's managed to persuade CEOs, incredibly, to release their time diaries under confidentiality, what they do every half an hour for a week.
It's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The most controversial fact about CEOs, at least in the mind of the public, is that they are just paid too much. In 2016, the CEOs of the top 350 U.S. firms earned an average of $15.6 million. Adjusted for inflation, that's a more than 900% increase since 1978. During that same period, the typical employee's compensation rose just over 10%. We've been hearing that good leadership is essential to good business performance, so maybe CEOs deserve that huge compensation. Why would a board pay it if they weren't getting their money's worth? And what's the right amount to pay a CEO?
I think it's actually impossible to say what's the right amount a CEO should get paid.
That, again, is the Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom.
The numbers they get paid now seem astronomical. I mean, you know, there are CEOs getting paid hundreds of millions. So I find it hard to defend those amounts. But I also am aware that there is no one that can definitively say that's too much or too little. The second point is you do definitely want to pay these individuals a lot. Why? One is you want to select people into the job. It's frankly a horrible job. You know, I wouldn't want it. Being a CEO of a big company is a, you know, 100-hour-a-week job. It consumes your life. You really want to, you know, make sure that they're motivated and also rewarded. And since these individuals are running massive companies, their actions affect all of us, you know, every day.
All that said and done, they're still way overpaid.
That's Jeff Sonnenfeld, the leadership expert from Yale.
And more than being overpaid, there's very little correspondence between performance and pay. There are some very strong companies historically, say United Parcel Service, which rank at the bottom in terms of compensation. But Philippe Dumont, who ran Viacom till recently, was being paid more than the very high-performing CEOs of Disney and Time Warner combined. And Viacom was a disaster. People like to talk about, you know, what's the ratio against the average employee. No, even worse is the lack of correspondence between pay and performance.
There is a lot of data to back up Sonnenfeld's claim. A huge study in the Journal of Management in 2000 found that the size of a firm accounts for more than 40% of the variance between CEO salaries, while firms' performance accounts for less than 5%. A more recent study of over 400 large-cap U.S. firms found that higher CEO pay was correlated with worse-than-median stock market returns. So let's say you're trying to do better. Let's say you are trying to link compensation to performance. There are the standard metrics of share price, profits, and so on, but how can you tell that a different CEO wouldn't have accomplished the same, or maybe even better? Which traits of a CEO could you measure to tell how good they are? And are there real empirical and statistical indicators of what makes a great CEO? Or is it mostly just leadership mumbo-jumbo?
There's been over 3/4 of a century of research on leadership traits. The bad news there is the sum total of it is very little of it matters in terms of static human traits that predict leadership greatness.
A 2012 study found that American firms spend about $14 billion a year on leadership training. Every year, publishers put out approximately 1 gazillion leadership books, which are primarily used to wallpaper the bookshops in airports. Divulging the secrets of great leadership is, of course, a long-standing tradition among its most enduring practitioners, Sun Tzu, Plato, and, of course, Machiavelli. These days, leadership courses and institutes are pretty much everywhere. So how good is the evidence to back up what they teach? As Jeff Sonnenfeld was telling us, the search for such evidence has been problematic for a while.
In the aftermath of the Second World War, a flight of scholars who escaped the Holocaust came to the U.S. to help create something between sociology and psychology called social psychology that really had no history before that. And its academic definition was really trying to understand the psychology of energized groups. But because of the experience so many had with charismatic leaders out of control, it became the vogue to focus on groups to the detriment of looking at leadership. We were afraid to look at charismatic leadership and often had some very simplistic notions out there in popular media, but in university worlds, we actually weren't teaching leadership. Even at the Harvard Business School, the supposed West Point of capitalism, was very hard to actually take a look at individual leaders, and that became the norm throughout business school.
One of the first people to look at what goes into the activities of a manager is Harry Mintzberg.
Rafael Sadoun again.
Who did some pioneering work in the 70s by measuring the activity of 5 CEOs, and that's what he based his PhD thesis on.
Henry Mintzberg's thesis was called The Manager at Work, Determining His Activities, Roles, and Programs by Structured Observation. Mintzberg got his PhD at MIT, and all the CEOs he studied ran firms in the Boston area, except for one, the Bulova Watch Company in New York. The rest were Massachusetts General Hospital, the Newton School System, Arthur D. Little Consulting, and a technology firm called EG&G, which, for what it's worth, was bought decades later by the Carlyle Group. Mintzberg shadowed each of the 5 CEOs full-time for a week. He recorded every activity they did during that time, every meeting, every phone call, and so on. Also, what they said and wrote and to whom, and what was said and written to them, and the action it elicited in the CEO.
And there is a ton of knowledge that has been generated by his research.
Mintzberg argued, for instance, that a CEO had 10 primary roles that fell into 3 categories: interpersonal, informational, and decisional. For instance, among the decisional roles were negotiator and resource allocator, but also disturbance handler. Now, granted, it wasn't a large study, only 5 CEOs, remember, but at least Mintzberg started to bring some scientific method to the supposed science of management. But as Rafael Sadoun tells us, it didn't really catch on.
After this initial push, there was very little large-scale representative research.
And with very little large-scale representative research, a lot of the modern leadership gospel was based on observing high-profile individual CEOs.
What we know about CEOs was pretty much based on exemplary people, people that were somehow famous. And so it's hard to really think, you know, is that representative or not? Probably not.
And you can imagine all kinds of faulty conclusions based on such unrepresentative observation.
There's a long-held view that CEOs maybe are selected for being risk takers. So imagine there are 2 types of CEOs. There's the boring ones and the ones that take huge gambles. At the beginning of their career, the boring ones plod along, but they never make it to the top. Of the huge gamblers, some of them win early on. So they get promoted. They gamble again. Some of those win again and they get promoted and they gamble again. And, you know, at the end of it, you can see that of the big gamblers, very few make it, but those that do get to the top. And so being a CEO, I think, is horribly selected on having taken a lot of big bets in the past and then successively paying off. So risk-taking is an attribute we end up selecting in our successful CEOs, but I'm not sure it's actually one that you'd want if you pick someone at the outset. Steve Jobs famously had his reality distortion field and ignored all his advice and pushed ahead and did well anyway. But I could mention Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos, who also apparently had a reality distortion field. And, you know, the company crashed and burned, and I'm sure there are 50 other examples of Theranos out there. So I'm very nervous about taking these anecdotes looking only at winners. I think if you want to do well, you want to look at winners and losers. Basically, take everyone that starts and see who tracks. And I think then you'll find the risk-taking CEOs, many of them crash and burn. We just never notice them because they drop out of the press.
So that's the problem. What's the solution? Enter the World Management Survey.
The World Management Survey was a project started up back in the early 2000s to try and rigorously measure management practices in large samples of firms from around the world. So by now, 15 years later, we have about 40,000 companies from around 40 countries. So we have the US, the UK, but also Vietnam, Brazil, Australia, China, India. And it was just to try and be more scientific about what defines good or bad management. So we wanted to randomly pick companies. So we have losers and winners.
The idea being that if you had enough data and the data were truly representational, you could identify the specific qualities that contribute to good leadership.
And we just really struggled to come up with anything. We didn't find we could identify the secret sauce.
But Bloom points to current research by Rafaela Sadoun as potentially groundbreaking. She's been doing a bunch of studies.
Not looking at who CEOs are, but what they do. So she's managed to persuade CEOs, incredibly, to release their time diaries under confidentiality, what they do every half an hour for a week.
That's right. Rafaela Sadoun decided to pull a Henry Mintzberg.
But we could also put Mintzberg on steroids.
While the Mintzberg study relied on his shadowing five CEOs, Sadoun and her colleagues have been studying more than 1,000 CEOs of manufacturing firms across six countries. Doing all this in person, as Mintzberg did, would have been impossible.
So instead, what we did is we decided to create a project called the Executive Time Use Project, which essentially allows us to shadow not the CEO personally, but the agenda of the CEO. So we get information on every activity that happens in the life of the CEO.
The researchers created from scratch a call center and hired 45 people to call the CEOs or their personal assistants every day.
In the morning and at night, to get a sense of what was planned in their agenda and what they actually did. We decided to also keep track of, is it a meeting, not only the type of meeting or type of activity, but also who was involved, the number of participants, who the participants were, whether the meeting was planned or not planned. Is the CEO maybe on the golf course? Is it a personal activity? Believe me, we have a lot of personal activities that are coded into our data. We don't use it for research, but it's kind of fun and validates the data a little bit.
Validating the data is, of course, important. After all, they're mostly self-reported data. And we all know that self-reported data have a habit of making ourselves look slightly better than we are. But Sadoun did have something to offer the CEOs in exchange for honest data.
We told them, look, if you allow us to shadow what you do and to measure what you do, we will give you a report back that tells you what goes into your day, how long do you work, what do you spend your time on, and also we'll give you a sense of what your peers do. And that was the key, because there is a tremendous appetite to know, what am I doing? Am I doing it right? What are my colleagues doing?
Another potential limitation of the study, these were only manufacturing firms, so the findings wouldn't necessarily be universal. Also, the CEOs who chose to participate were slightly more likely to run smaller firms. Still, this time use data has led to some significant insights.
What we find in the data is essentially two very different ways of allocating time. And in the paper, we label these leaders and managers. So let me start with managers. This manager is a CEO that spends a lot of time basically doing a lot of operational activities and often in meetings that involve one person at a time. The other type, which we call the leader, is a completely different way of allocating time. Instead of focusing on just one function, the meetings typically involve many functions at the same time, more people.
Okay. So manager CEOs and leader CEOs operate quite differently. What are the consequences of those differences? Sadoun and her colleagues found that the firms run by a leader-type CEO were more productive and more profitable. But wait a minute. Earlier, Sadoun and Bloom told us that CEOs who focus on good solid management, on operations, for instance, that they're more successful. And now, Sadoun is telling us that a leader-type CEO is more likely to be correlated with success than a manager-type. How can that be?
We don't think that this correlation reflects the fact that leaders are always better for firms.
What's that mean? If the firms run by the leader-type CEOs are more profitable and more productive, doesn't that mean that leader-type CEOs are more effective?
We think that what's happening in the background is something a little bit different, which is that leaders might be good in certain situations, might not be good in others, but that some firms that really need a leader actually end up with a manager. So it's more of an assignment problem of who gets hired to do what relative to a difference in the intrinsic quality of managers.
In other words, the right CEO for a given company is, well, it's hard to say. It might be a manager type, might be a leader type. It might be a big, brassy, backslapping, rally the troops type of CEO, or it might be a quiet, studious, lead by example kind of CEO.
They're so different. From outgoing to quiet to internal to external focus, just a whole range of practices.
Nicholas Bloom's obsession to identify the secrets to good leadership has stretched on for years.
But we just couldn't pick up any characteristic. Maybe it just doesn't exist. Maybe there's just many different ways to be a great leader.
Case in point, remember when Bloom told us the one thing that excluded someone from becoming a big-time CEO?
And sure, we can rule out people that typically dropped out of school at 15.
So how can you explain this guy?
I've never had to report to anybody since I left school at 15.
And that is?
My name is Richard Branson, and what do I do? I do everything Virgin.
Coming up next, how to become a CEO. Origin stories, unlikely triumphs, and how to recover from a really, really bad mistake.
I blew the roof off the factory. Fortunately, no one was killed.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We've been talking today about what makes a CEO successful. But as it turns out,
you look at the data and there's 10 different recipes for success.
That, again, is the Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom. He's been studying leadership for years.
No one could really give us a straight answer on what defined a good or a bad leader. Sure, there are some people that are better than others, but it's damn hard to tell what it is.
You'd think there'd be some sort of a template for what makes a successful CEO, some set of common characteristics. But as Nicholas Bloom and others have told us, the data tell a different story. It's very hard to pin down just what produces or predicts or even indicates a good CEO. In the absence of great statistical evidence, we'll go the anthropological route and ask the question, how do you become a CEO? Of the CEOs we've been interviewing, 4 of them got an MBA from an elite school, 2 have law degrees, 1 has a PhD. On the other end of the spectrum, 1 is a college dropout and 1 is a high school dropout.
I was 16 when I started off in business, so I was virgin at business.
You may recognize that voice.
Yeah, my name is Richard Branson, and what do I do? I do everything Virgin.
Now, your title, your official title, as far as I can tell, is founder, Virgin Group. In addition to that, are you the CEO of anything?
I used to be. But I've delegated pretty well all the CEO roles.
You created your own path and just kept going and kept having ideas, kept trying, failed, didn't let it bother you, and so on. But from the original, the magazine, student magazine, which was a culture magazine, to record stores, record label, airlines, trains, mobile phone company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know who you might have looked to as a model for that.
First of all, I never thought of myself as a business person or an entrepreneur. I just initially just thought of myself as an editor and wanted to have a magazine to campaign against the Vietnamese war. But in order for the magazine to survive, I had to worry about printing and paper manufacturing and distribution and so on. And I sort of became an entrepreneur. And, you know, my education was, you know, being in the real world and, you know, learning the art of survival.
I am the only child of two parents who both dropped out of high school.
That, again, is David Rubenstein, a founder of the Carlyle Group, one of the biggest private equity firms in the world. Until recently, he was also its co-CEO. He went to Duke University on a scholarship, then law school at the University of Chicago. After a couple years in New York doing corporate law, he moved to Washington.
I worked for Ted Sorensen, who had written that great speech for John Kennedy. He helped me get a job, which ultimately led me to the Carter campaign. So at 27, I was the deputy domestic policy advisor to the President of the United States, a job I obviously wasn't qualified for.
Now, I've read that you stayed late at your job to make sure that your memos were on top of the president's briefing pile.
It's, for better or worse, completely true. I would take into the president's private study my memos and bypass the staff system and put my memos on top. So when the president came in the morning, he would read my memos first because they were on the top of the inbox. And that had the advantage of bypassing everybody else's comments on my memos, which was a way of beating the system. It wouldn't be something I would tell my three children. It would be a good way to get ahead. But I would say sometimes you do things in life that in hindsight, with wisdom and gray hair, you realize probably don't look so good.
I came from a dairy farm in Wisconsin. My mom died when I was 8, so I was very motivated always to do well, the good girl.
That's Carol Bartz. She was CEO of the software firm Autodesk for 14 years and later CEO of Yahoo.
I actually was very fortunate to get a computer science degree from the University of Wisconsin in 1971.
Good timing.
And I fell into a world that I just loved. And I could continue in that world for, you know, the next 40 years.
Talk for just a minute about how being a woman affected your career, if you can kind of measure that input.
First of all, it was easier in the beginning because not many people had computer science degrees, and so they didn't care if you were orangutan, you could, you know, get a job because they didn't understand what was going on and they thought maybe you could help them. And, you know, as time went on and I was able to move up, I was fortunate enough to have some very good mentors and leaders that believed in me, and I was ornery.
I think I'm a product of two amazingly unique American things.
That's Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft.
The first is this technology that reached me where I was growing up that even made it possible for me to dream the dream. And then the enlightened American immigration policy that would be like to debate, but it allowed me to come here in the first place and live the dream. Only in America would a story like mine be possible.
In addition to you, the CEOs of Google, Adobe, MasterCard, and many other big American firms are Indian American, often immigrants like yourself. How do you account for that massive success?
Well, I mean, of those companies, other than the Sundar at Google, we all went to the same high school even. So I don't know. Maybe it was the water. First of all, I think it's sort of one of those false positives that you can take too much out of, right? Which is, I think each of us had our own unique story and a unique path. It's, after all, a country with billion people.
But a relatively low immigration rate for most of the immigration.
That is correct. I think what you're seeing here is that there was this tech boom, especially starting in the early 90s. There was a good supply of engineering graduates out of the country, and demand meets supply, and the enlightened immigration policy, I think, is what made it possible.
You know, I think my dad has a lot of fun stories about how he got me into technology.
That's Mark Zuckerberg, founder and CEO of Facebook.
He took a lot of pride in being, you know, the first dentist in the area who did digital x-rays instead of physical
really?
Ones.
Oh.
And he's just such a geek. But he was always just like, Mark, don't you think this is cool? I mean, I think my sisters were happy enough to play the games that I programmed growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they prefer like playing a snowball fight game or some strategy game that I made, even if the graphics were terrible and the game wasn't that good, right? Because I was still learning how to program. I was like 12 or 13 or 14. They'd prefer that to getting chased around the house with a super soaker.
You probably already know that Zuckerberg dropped out of Harvard.
10 years ago, you know, I was just trying to help connect people at colleges and a few schools.
He's probably the most accidental CEO we spoke with.
Yeah, well, I never started this to build a company.
At 33, Zuckerberg is also the youngest CEO we interviewed. The oldest, at 82, is Jack Welch, former longtime CEO of General Electric.
Treating everybody the same is ludicrous, and I don't buy it.
Welch joined GE in 1960 with a PhD in chemical engineering. It was a different era.
Well, let's start with differentiation. I learned differentiation when I was 11 years old in the playground. And the other guys were 15 and 16. And what happens to the worst player? He picks last and he goes to right field. That's differentiation. I mean, that hasn't changed in my mind from the first day I went to the playground.
Welch spent his whole 40-year career with GE, the last 20 as its CEO.
It's not cruel and Darwinian and things like that that people like to call it. A baseball team publishes every day the batting averages, and you don't see the 180 hitter getting all the money or all the raises. Athletics is the purest form of differentiation because it's public. Business is more subtle. And it's more qualitative. So the precision isn't there to differentiate. So judgment's important. But you don't win with a gang of mediocre players in business or in baseball.
Yeah.
Do you want to be in the loser's locker room or the winner's locker room? What's more fun?
When you look back at your tenure at GE, you had an awful lot of different issues, controversies, occasional crises. You had financial, you had environmental, you had some involving personnel.
Right.
Walk me through what felt at the time like the worst one and how you addressed it.
Well, I blew up a factory.
Yeah, that was early on, right?
Early on.
And tell the story about how your boss, or maybe it wasn't your immediate boss.
My immediate boss didn't know me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He made sure he got away from me, and I blew the roof off the factory. Fortunately, no one was killed.
Yeah.
And I was called down to New York to explain what happened by my boss's boss's boss. So I met this guy really for the first time.
This guy named Charlie Reed, I believe?
Yeah. Good for you. You did some homework.
All right. You're expecting what from Charlie now?
I didn't know him, so I didn't know what to expect, but I expected I might get fired.
Yeah.
I drove down to my Volkswagen from Pittsfield. I met Charlie, and all he did, it turns out he was a PhD chemical engineer from MIT. So he took me to the Socratic method. Do you know why it happened? What would you do differently? Why did you do that? Why did you do this? And he was coaching me, and he couldn't be nicer. And I learned from that and never kick anybody when they're down.
Hmm.
Kick them when they start to swell, but don't kick somebody when they're down. And Charlie did a hell of a job of coaching me through the error I made in blowing oxygen through benzene without enough grounding.
And you think that changed the way that you managed going forward?
Right.
That was, you know, almost 20 years before you took over.
Yeah, but it changed my life forever.
From the outside, it's tempting to assume that the path of a chief executive has been a straight line, a procession of victories, small and large. That is rarely the case. Failure is not only common among the CEO class, but to some degree, desirable. Nicholas Bloom again.
You need that experience of adversity. In Silicon Valley, there's this old saying about you actually love to fund people that have had one or two business failures, but three or more is pure carelessness.
Oh, yeah. And then I had my kicked in enough times. And yeah, I remember the moment. In late 1980, 81.
That's Ray Dalio. At the time, he was running a small hedge fund called Bridgewater Associates.
I had calculated that American banks had lent to foreign countries a lot more money than those countries were going to be able to pay back.
Dalio's calculation turned out to be right. This brought him a lot of attention from Wall Street. He was asked to testify before Congress. Dalio told anyone who would listen that the looming debt crisis would inevitably lead to a stock market crash.
I was so wrong. I had to let clients go. I lost money. I got so broke that I had to borrow $4,000 from my dad and letting go people who were like extended family. It was literally down to me. That was a very painful experience, but it was one of the best experiences that happened in my life because it changed my perspective from thinking I'm right to asking myself, how do I know I'm right?
Dalio rebuilt Bridgewater from scratch.
And that began the whole process of trying to find the smartest people I can find who disagree with me and be curious about what they think to create a culture in which there's independent thinking.
Bridgewater would become famous for using algorithms to make decisions and for practicing what Dalio called radical honesty and radical transparency.
The senior partner said that you're making people uncomfortable, you're demoralizing them with your straightforwardness.
But it worked. Bridgewater is now the biggest hedge fund in the world. 1,500 employees, roughly $160 billion under management. Dalio, who recently stepped down as co-CEO, has a net worth of around $17 billion. He traces his success back to having weathered and learned from that early failure.
We have a challenge of being able to deal with our own imperfections and our own weaknesses, and our own being wrong. And our society reinforces that. It's reinforced in schools about, you know, okay, you got the grades right, you're right. It doesn't reinforce the notion of failure and learning from failures and that whole experience.
Well, we've made plenty of mistakes, as everybody in this business has.
David Rubenstein again, from the Carlyle Group.
Anybody that tells you they haven't made a mistake probably really isn't in the business or isn't being honest.
Carlyle is a private equity firm, buying established companies, sometimes replacing their CEOs, and ultimately selling them off. This is not to be confused with a venture capital firm, which generally funds startups.
I don't think I have the skill set in venture capital. I passed on Facebook when Mark Zuckerberg was in college, and I had a chance to be an early owner of Amazon and effectively turn it down.
Still, Rubenstein is among the most experienced people on the planet when it comes to observing CEOs. Carlyle has acquired or invested in nearly 600 companies in aerospace, healthcare, energy, media, financial services, you name it. So Rubenstein has formed some rules of thumb.
Running companies is different than getting them off the ground. I think it's much harder to get them off the ground. But generally, the companies that are going to make it, with some exceptions, are the companies that have a CEO, founder, who has driven the company for the first couple years and really driven it to success. And then you bring in a CEO who's better at managing a more mature company than somebody who's getting it off the ground. Some of the greatest managers of companies in the world are not great entrepreneurs. And some great entrepreneurs are not really good at managing companies.
In the latter category, Travis Kalanick of Uber comes to mind. Great entrepreneur. As a manager, much less great, which is why Kalanick is no longer the CEO of Uber. As for successful CEOs who weren't entrepreneurs, there's Lou Gerstner, who ran IBM and RJR Nabisco, Alan Mulally, who ran Ford, and before that, a division of Boeing. But what about the third group? Company founders who go on to successfully run their firm.
It's a rare person like Bill Gates, who was an entrepreneur and also was a very effective CEO for many, many years.
The high-profile nature of those relatively few excellent founder CEOs, you mentioned Bill Gates, you know, you could say Mark Zuckerberg at this point, you could say Jeff Bezos at this point, you could say Steve Jobs while he was alive. Do you think they give a kind of skewed, anomalous view of what the CEO should be? In other words, it should be the founder, or at least it would be best if it were the founder?
Well, clearly, they get all the attention, and so it does give people something to aspire to. But probably most companies 5 years into the formation of the company are not being run by the person who conceived of the company and might have started it. It's just a different skill set, and very few people have the skill set that Jeff Bezos exhibited or Bill Gates exhibited. It just usually doesn't happen.
In the case of Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, it wasn't at all clear that the founder would make it as the CEO.
I thought he showed an incredible audacity to not learn and listen as a leader.
That's Jeff Sonnenfeld, a leadership scholar at Yale.
Oh my gosh, has he changed? And he had a great board, great mentors, and also he's just been a great learner. He has been remarkably different now as a leader than he was when he first became CEO.
I actually think the most important thing is what decisions and what process on a day-to-day basis you choose to let people have the freedom to do and just not get involved with.
And that's Zuckerberg.
A huge part of how Facebook works is giving a large amount of freedom to our engineers at the company and to people who use the product to make with it what they will, right? And trusting people to do that rather than...
Was that hard for you to get to, or...?
I think it's hard every day. I think because when you're running something, you, of course, have the ability to make as many of the decisions as you would like. So the real art, I think, is not not when you know that you have someone who's a superstar who's going to make great decisions, but deciding to let people do things that you disagree with because on principle and you know it's just going to free up more creativity and people will feel like there's more potential to try different things in the future that may be better if you let them go do those things, even if you disagree with them.
Too many young entrepreneurs, you know, just want to cling on to everything, and they're not good delegators.
Richard Branson again, the founder of Virgin.
If I'm ever giving a talk to a group of young business people, I will tell them, you know, go and take a week out to find somebody as good or better than yourself.
I know that once when you were asked how involved you are in the mechanics of your businesses, you said, I don't understand these things completely. And you said, I've never been able to know the difference between net and gross. I'm guessing you were exaggerating at least a little bit or no?
Well, I'm quite badly dyslexic. And it was on my 50th birthday that I was having a meeting with a group of executives, and I asked the question, is that good news or bad news, when some figures were given to me. And one of the executives took me outside the room, and he had some colouring pencils, and he had a blank sheet of paper, and he coloured in this piece of paper blue, and then he put a net, a fishing net amongst it, and he put little fish in the fishing net. And he said, Richard, I don't think you know the difference between net and gross. And let me simplify it for you. The fish in the net are your profit, and all the fish that are not in the net are your gross turnover. And hey presto, I got it. And ever since then, I've been, you know, very swankily saying net profit and gross turnover.
Over the next few shows, we'll be trying to learn as much as we can about who CEOs actually are and what they actually do. As we've been hearing today, academic research on the subject indicates there is no template, no set of neat, identifiable characteristics that will predict who will succeed and who will fail. We accept that fact. Indeed, we will revel in it. We'll talk to a bunch of CEOs and try to understand their lives, their decisions, their successes and failures. So coming up next time on Freakonomics Radio, all right, the CEO chair is suddenly empty and you have got to fill it. What happens now?
We can't take one of these knuckle-dragging drones from within to save us.
Even the day before they told me that I was going to be CEO, I didn't think that I was going to become CEO.
I was on the sidelines thinking what I would do if I got it. And when I got it, I did it.
Tradition versus change. Insiders versus outsiders. Microsoft versus the world. That's next week. And if you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, or visit the Freakonomics website, where we will be posting the full interviews with CEOs from this series. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.